by degree here, I was Greek less. Visiting CETA for 6 weeks. As Nyanesh showed you, I have over the years worked in different areas of theoretical astrophysics. But actually, for the last 9 years, this is the National Center for Radio Astrophysics, and the Tata Institute has a strong group in theoretical astrophysics, theoretical physics. But I'm here for a different reason, which is okay.
Don't you want to put on the microphone?
Yeah, I should.
And then turn it on also.
I should do a lot of things.
Yeah.
I should get this on. Yeah, so this is the talk which I gave at the CETA. It's still a picture of the telescope of our observatory, which I thought is worth showing. It's really large. G stands for giant meter wave radio telescope. And the reason why I'm at CETA is that there's a very interesting experiment led by Wellington and CETA at this place, so we have a lot in common to discuss. Now, of course, this is what's in common between telescopes and my topic. This is a picture of a particular galaxy, a dwarf galaxy. Does it make sense for me to move to this side? Probably yes. Yeah, a dwarf galaxy, which is actually being made with a telescope. So this is what the optical people see, just this little bit. And this is what you see in neutral hydrogen, which goes way beyond. And of course, it enables you to look at the dark matter by measuring the rotation and so on. So in some sense, if you like, this is why a galactic dynamicist might even be in the place where I am. But now, so let's get down to business. So if you have, let's say, stars or dark matter particles constituting a galaxy, and you would like to write down a kind of theoretical physics model for it, and a model which was introduced by Mr. Jeans many years ago, is what you could call a collisionless space-space fluid. So what that really means is that you think of all these particles as belonging to a six-dimensional phase-space. Okay. So that means you're not really worrying about higher order between these particles. And they have a distribution function, which is f. And it's a mean field picture. So what you're really saying is that if you know this distribution function, so it starts from the bottom line, you could integrate it over velocity, and you could get the density. I mean, that's for a particular normalization. Normally, we think of f as giving the number of particles in some range in phase space, but it's quite straightforward to normalize it in a different way. So that gives you the total mass when you integrate it over velocity and over position, which are our two independent variables here. So if you just integrate over velocity, you get the real space density. From that, you can compute a potential. And from that, gravitational potential, you can compute a gravitational acceleration. Right? And once you have a gravitational acceleration, then you know how the distribution function behaves. I mean, that's it. It's only the mean field that you're talking about. So this is at the heart of galaxy dynamics. And so this is really the Liouville equation combined with the Poisson equation. And that would be the logical thing to call it, at least in Quebec or something like that. But for some reason in the literature, and the famous book in this field, incidentally, is a book by Pinney and Tremaine, which has just come out in its second edition. It's a great book, but on the other hand, it would take a little longer to read than just sitting in the lecture. So I mean, these are the different things we call it, but the important thing is it's a mean field, right? So you're smoothing out the particles, computing the potential, and using that potential to evolve the distribution function. And of course, this whole thing is nonlinear because, right, this innocent looking A actually contains F. Okay. So the more pictorial thing is to take the phase space. Think of the distribution function as some kind of blob in phase space. Of course, this is the simplest kind where it's sometimes called a water bag, where you have a constant value inside and zero outside. But you could have a gradient. So now you have to evolve this. So you use, you first project this down on the Q axis, get density, computer potential, use that potential to compute the flow rate basis, which means that the change in P is, of course, right, it's proportional to this acceleration, and the change in Q is proportional to P. So you have this kind of flow. So the whole distribution function keeps changing, and the potential keeps changing. So this is not a trivial problem. Right? I mean, it's true we have a differential equation. And we know that, see, what we have is self-consistency. Okay? Now, even without self-consistency, the properties of these flows in more than one space dimension, so more than two, so 2 + 2 phase space dimensions and higher, these flows can be integrable, they can be non-integrable, that's a whole field in itself. And a field which is relevant to the discussion we will have. We'll see the relevance of that. So what can one do? Well, one thing is, of course, before computers, people naturally look for exact solutions. And motivated by the idea that galaxies are some kind of steady state, one looks for exact stationary solutions. So without the time dependence and the distribution function. It turns out there are also exact time dependent solutions. It's something one of my graduate students worked on, and I may say a little bit about it. Not too much, because it also turns out that they may not be very relevant to real galaxies. Of course, today we can go for numerical solutions, both of the stationary case and the time dependent case. And of course, time dependent is important because, in a cosmological context, we know these galaxies were put together from perturbations, so they were not in a stationary state. So you would actually like to know how it approaches a stationary state, and that is sort of related to this line. Is there something which tells you what's the equilibrium, how it goes to equilibrium? So that's what I really meant in the title by saying, you address it the way that physicists have addressed similar problems in condensed matter and so on. So let's begin with stationary solutions. And the basic idea is due to genes. So you want to make DFDT 0. So if you look at the right-hand side, the right-hand side is exactly how, okay, maybe I should go back to that. So this right-hand side is exactly how F would change as you follow the trajectory of an individual particle, because the rate of change of X is V and the rate of change of V is A. Okay? So if you knock this term off, all that you're really saying is that F is constant along a Michael trajectory. Or, I mean, you can also think of this as the Poisson bracket of F, Hamiltonian, and, you know, that means you want that to be zero. Okay? So here we are. Right? So the ansatz, which is really called Jean's theorem, is that you make F a function of conserved quantities. Okay? So I think let's warm up with the spherical case. Now, most galaxies are not spherical. On the other hand, globular clusters are spherical, and we will see that this has some application, of course. So, I didn't quite get it right here, but let's just choose the energy as a constant of motion, okay? So you have this, an energy per unit mass. This is the gravitational potential term, which we don't know to start with, okay? And I mean, instead of being vague and saying choose any function of this, let's even be more specific and choose an exponential with a negative sign. So that, if you like, is vaguely motivated by statistical mechanics. You're saying, let's take exponential minus beta times this energy as the distribution function. Well, then you integrate that over velocities, right? And in the exponential case, that's pretty easy, right? So all you are left with an exponential of the potential. But even if it is not exponential, you'll be left with some function of the potential, right? So if you're following this track, your density is some nonlinear function of the potential. And in the special case, it's exponential. So then your Poisson equation is a nonlinear Poisson equation. And so this is how a spherical system where the distribution function is just a function of energy would work. Okay. So you end up solving L squared phi as this. And the particular case where it is an exponential function is a sort of famous case. It has interesting properties. You can get back to them, but I guess what I should mention is L squared phi is exponential minus phi has a solution of 2 log r So if you take the exponential of that, you get a density going at 1 over r squared, and which, strangely, many galaxies seem to follow. Because the density going at 1 over r squared actually gives you a flat rotation curve. So that's suggestive. On the other hand, we've just made a number of arbitrary choices along the line, so let's not get carried away. This was really meant to just illustrate how the machinery works if you're trying to make a steady state system, which is spherically symmetric. So now let's see how the machinery works in the case of, say, something like our galaxy, which is nowhere near spherically symmetric, but it's reasonably close to axis symmetric. So you have a pivot axis, you have a plane. Well, the same general idea works. You choose a function of the z component of the angular momentum, because that's what's conserved, and the energy. So now you have a function of two variables, which is just as well, because you're now going to match, let's say you were trying to match observations. You're going to choose this, you know, the function which is free to start with, to match the measured density of the galaxy. So the measured density is a function of two variables. So in the previous case, we had to match only a function of the radius, so it was fine to choose a function of one variable. So here we now have a function of two variables. And if you integrate out the velocities to get the density, you will be now left with r and phi. Okay. So then you can solve this nonlinear equation. And this has been done. So in some sense, an axis symmetric galaxy doesn't cause you much more problem than the previous case. I mean, you might have to go to numerical work either to carry out this step or to carry out this step. But the program is straightforward, and the program is pretty well posed. I mean, you can solve this kind of thing by put the right boundary condition to infinity. So there are already some interesting things which happen at this stage. One of them is that is interesting is that we have not actually said anything about the orbits in this projection. So you manage to build a model of this galaxy without really worrying about how individual stars orbit, because it's a collective.
So, Rajan, one thing is that this is not the most general possibility, right?
I'm going a little further, so you might see whether what you have in mind is also included. Okay. But in the axis symmetric case, this is the most straightforward possible, because these are the two conservation laws which we are guaranteed in any axis symmetric picture. Right? So that's what I'm saying. I mean, that's what I'm saying at this stage. But there's already reason to go beyond this. And that reason is actually observational. So it's all interesting how you can go from this kind of fairly, you know, abstract, not abstract, but fairly theoretical approach to something which is observational. But if you build a model this way, then you immediately realize one prediction you can make. So your distribution function depends on velocities, both through this and this. But as far as the, so you know, you have this axis symmetric galaxy, and you have the phi direction, the z direction perpendicular to the plane, and the r direction, the radial direction. Notice that vr and vz don't enter in the angular momentum, they only enter in the energy. So your dependence on radial velocity and on the z component velocity are essentially going to be the same. Like if you compute it from this distribution function, I mean, and this has nothing to do with self-consistency, just the form you've made. You will get the same value for the mean square random velocity in the z direction and the r direction. Now it's actually been, yeah, so this is the same point that I made. Now, it's been known for 100 years. I mean, people collected the radial velocities of stars and in the neighborhood of the sun. This was a late 19th century, early 20th century project. And the same Schwarzschild who brought you the Schwarzschild solution also came up with a fit to this distribution of, which is actually an ellipsoid. It has different mean square values in all three directions. Okay? So already, even in our own galaxy, and directly from observation, you know that something interesting must be happening. And it actually took, I mean, took a long time for people to get down to this, but by the 1950s, people were constructing models of galaxies, which, at least in a practical sense, had one more conservation law. So maybe I could illustrate this. I didn't put in that figure.
So the charts in the box here.
Okay. Yeah, I think this is bright enough that you can see. Which part of the board is
visible? This board is actually easier. It's this part.
Oh, okay, right. Yeah. No, this will work.
Yeah.
Right. So if you take this access symmetric potential and you fix the value of LZ, then you of course have this centrifugal barrier. So then if you take the effective potential for motion in the, right, so V effective for motion in the R Z plane, right? So I mean, the actual potential of course has a minimum right at the center, but effective potential, because of the centrifugal term, it could be something like this. Where if you now are sitting here, you're just on a circular orbit, you're sitting at the bottom of this potential. So this is some general potential in two variables. And so you have no reason to expect a conservation law other than the energy. And if that was true, the star would sort of go everywhere in a region like this. And that's what really equalizes Vz squared and Vr. But when people actually integrated orbits, they actually got something like Lissajous figure, which means that in some qualitative sense, it was behaving like a two-dimensional harmonic oscillator. Even though it was not a two-dimensional harmonic oscillator, I mean, it is, of course, close to this point it is, but as you go further away, it's, so there's, I think, investigation of this problem actually gave rise to some of the earliest studies in chaos. I think one of the most famous papers in chaos is called this Enon-Hyres paper. And the title of the paper is, you know, Existence of a Third Integral in a Galactic Potential. This is sort of interesting. As a sidelight, you can look up, because Enon is well known in celestial mechanics. If you look up Karl Hyres, he's a hardcore radio astronomer. He did this as a small project at Princeton for Enon, and that is, of course, his most highly cited paper. So, although in theory the thing could go all over the place, in practice, at the moment you have something like a two-dimensional harmonic oscillator, you have one more conservation law, you know, like energy here and energy this way. So you can build models where the dispersion in this, in the z direction is different. Okay? So that's one thing which came out. Yeah. Now, I want to make another point by going back to spherical systems. Now, it's sort of interesting that I said to model a spherical run of density, you only need a function of one variable, and I chose a function of the energy. But actually, the spherical system is the system in which you have the maximum number of conservation laws, right? You could make it a function of L squared. Right? And I've even thrown in this, which looks a bit strange, because, sure, you can simply build a distribution function like that, but the question is, would it be self-consistent? Okay. And you might, at first sight, think not, because you're sort of preferring, you have a preferred z-axis, and then, you know, how would you get? But, I mean, just to make a somewhat technical or academic point, I want to tell you that you could have a system which has a spherical potential, but is not spherically symmetric in phase space. And the way you do it is as follows. So first forget is L squared, LZ. So this is perfectly okay. This respects full spherical symmetry in phase space. So let's say you build a galaxy like that. And actually this is useful. This is useful because if you build a model of a spherical galaxy using just E, you run into the same problem that the dispersion of radial velocities and the dispersion of tangential velocities is going to be the same. And if you have measurements on a globular cluster or a galaxy telling you these are different, then you just throw in one more integral of motion, L squared, which will now break, because this contains the tangential velocity squared, but not break. So that's straightforward. But you can also do one more, sort of, as I said, somewhat academic construction. This object still doesn't rotate, right? Because at any given radius, you have a velocity distribution which is symmetric, you know, I have things going both ways. Now suppose I just decided to take all the stars with negative LZ and reverse their LZ. Okay? They would still basically traverse the same orbits and, you know, and make the same contribution to the density. So now I would have achieved a system which is rotating, whose density and potential are spherically symmetric, but whose distribution function actually has a non-linear dependence on LZ, because, you know, in my trivial example, it is zero for LZ negative. So, I mean, that's one point, but I think the wider point, which sort of carries over to more interesting systems is that our intuition from ordinary fluids is that, you know, to make a system that the system is spherically symmetric is probably not rotating, and in order to make it flattened, you can rotate it. Okay. Now, this is an example of a system which is rotating but not flattened. Right? And if you ask where the intuition from ordinary fluids broke down, the point is ordinary fluids obey this Pascal's law. Quebec touch again. That you have pressure of the same in all directions. But the moment you allow the distribution function, this is collisionless, right? So you can have different stresses in different directions, and that's exactly. Now we now look at the reverse case that you can have flattening without rotation. And this again was strongly observationally motivated. That you know, you could look in an elliptical galaxy, or look at a whole family of them, and say, okay, even allowing for projection and so on, we expect them to rotate at some certain rate if the rotation is only due to, if the flattening is only due to rotation. And then it turned out they were rotating much more slowly. Okay.
So that
sort of forced people to think of triaxial systems. Now, of course, just by looking at the projection on the sky, you cannot tell whether. I mean, you would think you cannot tell whether a system is triaxial or, you know, it's just symmetric but about an axis in the plane of the sky. Okay? But actually, if one looks more carefully at the kind of projected density that you get, if you project a triaxial ellipsoid and look at it from a general angle, it actually tells you that it's triaxial. The elliptical contours and the inner region sort of twist with respect to the outer regions. So, and then once these systems were discovered, one had to model them. And now you see this imbalance between the number of constants of motion you need and the number of constants of motion that you actually have. In spherical systems, we needed only one, and we had three. In axisymmetric systems, we needed two, and we had two. Except to really fit observation, we needed a third. And in a completely triaxial potential, if it isn't something special, then you say, yes, I have the energy. But that simply will not work, because if you just have the energy, you go back to Pascal's law, the pressure is the same in all directions, and then there are theorems which tell you that the system cannot be triaxial. I mean, if someone's interested, there's something called the tensor variable theorem, which sort of tells you that you have the same velocities in all directions, that your geometric shape also have. So this is the kind of bind in which people found themselves when they had triaxial galaxies, and it was solved in very different ways by different people. So this is me. This is Martin Schwarzschild.
Yes. So you never mentioned dark matter in any of these discussions.
Well, I would even take the point of view that if there's a galaxy which is dominated by dark matter, then I'm only talking about the dark matter.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's fine.
Sure. But whenever you talk about observations, you talk about the
stuff. That's how.
So in principle, there could be both of the.
Yeah, but the stars, certainly, they move in the same potential. So that.
But it's not a self-consistent system anymore.
It is not. Okay, it is not self-consistent. That's true. So actually, sophisticated models build in both. But I don't think you can have very different symmetries for the two. I mean, they do. They are coupled. Yeah. The dark matter and the stars, so to that extent.
Probably.
So the Martin Schwarzschild solution is very interesting, and by this time computers, in fact he was one of the first people to apply computers for astrophysics. The early Princeton computers and did stellar evolution and wrote a marvelous book. But this was when he had moved to galaxies, long after most people retired. And I happened to hang around Princeton around that time and heard that he wrote all his own programs. And no question of lying to graduate students. So he took triaxial potentials, he integrated the orbits, and found effectively, you know, suppose it had the only conservation law was a conservation of energy, then it would go all over the energy surface, a bit like what I told you here. And you know, that would make life very difficult to model triaxial systems. But what he found is that, of course, effectively, just like this did behave like an oscillator, near the center of these triaxial models, things did behave like a three-dimensional oscillator. So you really had more constants. Effectively. But he took a very pragmatic, very numerical approach, and he classified the orbits into libraries, you know, those which look like boxes, those which look like loops, and so on. For each of them, you're going to build a density. And so how do you achieve self-consistency? You have to place the appropriate number of stars in each family of order. And apparently, he had this nice idea of borrowing the linear programming programs from the economics department or something like that. Because that's where, you know, you build up, you know, the final cost of something with positive weights. So that's what he did. And he actually found reasonable solutions for triaxial galaxies. And a little later, it was something of a rediscovery. Turned out that many years earlier, someone called G.G. Kunzmann had actually pulled out potentials which you will probably find only in the Mohsen Peshwar book. These are potentials which are separable in ellipsoidal coordinates, and therefore they actually have three constants of motion. And they were regarded as a complete curiosity. But it was Tim Lezio in the Netherlands who showed that these have the same orbit families that Schwarzschild found, and he was able to actually construct models which were almost completely analytic. So what I find very interesting about this, the way the whole subject developed, is that to start with, you might think a galactic potential is not strongly constrained. But because of this requirement of self-consistency, and because of the balance between constants of motion and dimensions that I told you about, it looks as if the galaxy finally selects a potential which has more constants of motion than you would get just from geometric symmetry. In fact, triaxial potentials, you know, do not have any geometric symmetry. They only have hidden symmetry, like the symmetry of these ellipsoidal potentials. So I find that quite interesting. So I've just coined a temporary term for it, which is self-organized integrability. See, unlike most systems, a galaxy can choose its potential. I mean, things, stars can move around and change their density. And it looks like the condition for a steady state actually forces you to this. Okay. Now, maybe I won't say too much about this magnetofluid, but I looked around for similar situations, and I did find one in MHD, but if anyone is interested, I mentioned that. Where again, you're sort of forced to more symmetry than you would think. Now, let's come to how the steady state is attained. And here there's a sort of famous paper by Lindenberg, which had many ingredients. He coined the term called violent relaxation. And this was really written in the 60s, where there wasn't that much of cosmological background. So he just said, let's take a bunch of particles and release them. They're not in a stationary state to start with, and will they reach a stationary state? So there are a couple of mechanisms involved in this. It's sort of interesting even from a pure physics or statistical physics point of view, because you are talking about a system which doesn't have an explicit collision term, no friction of any kind, and it still seems to reach a kind of equilibrium state. I mean, I say a kind of equilibrium state because nowhere have I implied that this is a state of thermal equilibrium. Okay. I mean, we had all these arbitrary functions, well, not completely arbitrary functions of these constants of motion which define our model. So there's certainly no unique model. You could build spherical models, triaxial models, so on. So again, going to other branches of physics, like plasma physics, there's this thing called Landau damping, which is in the textbooks. And part of the explanation of Landau damping is a much simpler phenomenon called phase mixing. So in 1+1 dimension, phase-space dimension, you just have constant energy orbits. And if you chose a distribution function, say which is spread out like this, I mean, this is certainly not stationary because, you know, it would start moving around. But because this is anharmonic, you would have different pieces which have different energies moving at different rates. And, you know, the thing would wind up. And of course, I've only shown one winding, but if you wind it many, many times, then effectively, you could say the distribution function that actually spread out over this entire region. In other words, it has got kind of averaged over the annihilated. So that's what is meant by phase mixing. Now, in a purely technical sense, we have maintained the reversibility. Okay? Because, you know, you could run it backwards and it would wind back and fill up the small region. And of course, we know the actual volume of this region cannot increase. That's the Liouville theorem. But what happens is that it kind of gets strung out. And then, if you're not concerned with this fine-grained distribution function, but you only want to calculate average values, look at the average behavior, if you do a coarse-grained distribution function, if you do a little bit of averaging over the energy, then effectively it sort of expanded and filled the field. Now, by the way, there is nothing new about this. You can actually look at the original Gibbs book on statistical physics, where he discusses the increase of entropy, of course, in 6n dimensions. And he actually has arguments of this kind. Even there's this lovely demonstration with glycerine and these highly viscous liquids where you crank them one way and they get spread out and you crank them back and the ink comes all the way back. And I think he even has a reference to that. But at least, so there's something in common with this kind of discussion and discussions on the foundations of statistical physics. You use the same terminology like force gradient and so on. So if you believe this, and there is reason not to believe it, because if the distribution function is a function of time, then the potential is also a function of time. So I should not be drawing these fixed. So if you like, this is a kind of perturbative picture where you say, well, towards the end of the whole process, we don't worry about the time dependence for the moment. We have got these integral potentials, which are action variables and angle variables. So now I'm trying to go beyond 1 plus 1 dimension. And because of phase mixing, things become functions only of the action variables. Okay? So this is sort of one ingredient of the Lidenberg picture. The other ingredient is, of course, the time dependence. So the time dependence also allows you to move, in some sense, in this direction. And this was again before very large-scale simulations. So this is the kind of physics that he came up with. He came up with a third idea, which I actually have not put in on the transparency, even though it's the most fascinating idea in his paper. And the third idea is, I didn't put it in simply because it's later on proved to be, not wrong, but oversimplified. He said, well, let's start with this kind of water bag that I mentioned, where the phase density has just two values. And, because of all this mixing, it's effectively going to get spread out over a bigger volume. So if I cut it into small pieces, I have to rearrange these pieces to occupy a bigger volume. But these pieces cannot overlap. So if you maximize entropy, you end up with a kind of Fermi statistics. So if you want to read a paper in the monthly notices of the Astronomical Society to deal with galaxies, but it ends up with Fermi statistics, you can read Lidenberg's paper. It's an interesting idea. It sort of implies that you really stir things around. And I've already told you how you can stir things around, but in detail it doesn't match simulations. On the other hand, as a basic idea, it's true. You cannot pack these different elements of phase space into a smaller than a certain region, and that's important. And so I've come to a more modest statement, which the title of this paper came many years later. It's late 80s, I think. So, we all have an H theorem in any. Say gases, we have Boltzmann's H theorem. So is there an H theorem for stellar systems? There is. It's a much weaker theorem, but it's still useful. These are the authors. So the water bag, which I gave you, is an example of an initial state where there is no fine structure in the distribution function. It doesn't fill some region. So you could say that the coarse grain distribution function equals the fine grain. Then you allow things to wind around, right? And of course, if you insist on looking at a fine-grained distribution function, then each volume of phase space conserves its phase space density, so the integral of f log f is going to be exactly the same. But if you do any coarse grading at all, then you can prove that the entropy associated with that increases. Again, this is not new, it's there in Tolman's book in the context of 6n dimensional phase space. It's important that this increase need not be monotonic. And I think that is one small point which is missed in this paper that I've corrected by later people, including one of my research students. Sorry, wrong way. So the point I wanted to make is that, take this distribution for example. So at this stage, it has, if I coarse grain, it has become a uniform function of angle. Fine. Now, if I allow it to wind a little more, it's no longer a uniform function of angle, because there's some region of angle which is represented twice. So if you compute the entropy of the distribution and angle, you will actually find it's not monotonic. And what you can prove is any final value would be greater than the initial value. But it starts from the initial value when coarse grain equals fine grain. It goes up and then it does what it likes. It can't come below the original value. So that's the weaker kind of Reed's theorem, which got clarified after this paper. And I think this is the student who worked with me. He's called Sridhar. He actually spent some time in CETA, but many, many years ago, now in the Raman Institute. And he actually constructed exact oscillating models. And of course, there would obviously be a counterexample to any naive Reed's theorem, right? Things come back to the same value. Now, I'm not telling you much about them, unless someone's interested, I can say later, simply because they are unrealistic from the galactic point of view. They have almost uniform densities, and so on. And Antonov and Lyubimov constructed oscillating models around the same time. The other interesting thing is that this H theorem is true not just for F log F, but for any convex function. And the consequences of that are explored in this paper. Again, if people are intrigued by that. Okay, so I said in the abstract that I'd try and make some connection between all this theory and astronomy. I've mentioned some things along the line. So now let's come to simulations. And many of the simulations are being done by people who are motivated by cosmological initial conditions or by galaxy mergers, things which actually happen in the universe. And they do show approach to a steady state, which more or less fits. And the steady state can sometimes be triaxial. So in that sense, some of this general modeling and theory has been vindicated by numerical simulations. It's also true that this fine structure in phase space, which you may not observe in an external galaxy, but in our own galaxy, it turns out that the local phase space has been mapped pretty well. And I think what really happens is this. I mean, the classical astronomers found it rather difficult to measure distance beyond some very short distance. They could measure one component of the velocity, which is the radial, and two components of the position. So they had exactly half the number of measurements that they needed to place a star in phase space. Now this amazing satellite called Hipparchos changed all that. On the one hand, it was able to measure distances out to 100 parsecs, which is reasonable, accurate distances. It was also able to measure the transverse motion, the so-called proper motion. And of course, the old radial velocities and coordinates are already available. So really, for the first time, sometime in the, well, maybe in this century actually, people started plotting nearby stars, you know, not like Schwarzschild did, purely in velocity space, but actually in phase space. And it actually revealed pretty rich structures, which tells us that, you know, a detailed view of our galaxy, this is again sort of in line with cosmology, because in cosmology things happen by mergers, you form bigger objects. And when you merge, it's not that all traces of the merger are completely removed. They are contained in this fine scale phase space structure. So that's the density profiles are reasonable, but if you look at them closely, there are a lot of interesting issues of reconciling simulations with observations. With the difficulty that Nyayesh mentioned, that you observe stars, you don't necessarily observe that matter. And finally, the phase space constraint, which I mentioned, is very useful. It's been used by, for example, if you make neutrino masses too small, this is a very classical thing, then you cannot pack them into galaxies to make the dark matter. And the kind of dwarf galaxy I showed you earlier, again, puts powerful constraints on the dark matter. Now, whether this can be made more sophisticated and you can actually look at density profiles and learn something about the dark matter. Now, everything I've told you so far has been collisionless. Okay. Now, even in the context of galaxies and dark matter particles, it's worth not taking this completely for granted, because we don't know what the dark matter is. It could have some interactions. So even in the cosmological context or the galactic context, it is worth understanding what lifting this collisional constraint does. And that's the last part of my talk, which is also interesting from a physics point of view. So now, what we've been talking so far is we have a total mass of the galaxy M, which is made up of N dark matter particles or stars, each with a mass smaller. And in some sense, we've been in the N tends to infinity limit. Okay. And the simplest thing you can say is that two particle interactions go hence, M into N, whereas the interaction of one particle with the potential goes M into capital M. So the effects of two bodies scattering would actually go as one over N. I can do better than this. I will do better than this in a minute. But this is just to motivate the basic physical idea that we have been in the fluid limit so far, and now we are trying to put in the discreteness of the particles. Okay? And this was done. This was done actually slightly earlier for stars than for plasmas. So you can actually compute a mean free path, and in the context of stars, various people, Jeans, Spitzer, Nagarjuna, and Chandrasekhar, they did it. And actually, classic work in plasmas is Landau. This is same Landau, but now talking about collision of plasmas. So he put down the collision term, which is essentially the same as what the stellar dynamics people came up with, except he did it in 2 pages. Right? And what took a whole book of Chandrasekhar and so on. That's Landau for you. But actually, it's not in the volumes he wrote, it's a posthumous volume, The Physical Kinetics. Okay? So how does this work? So I said Coulomb collisions. So so there is an impact parameter, which you can call the impact parameter for hard collisions. So if it comes that close, the kinetic energy V squared is of the same order as the potential energy Gm over V, and you get a large angle collision. And of course, if you're much greater than this impact parameter, then your deflection is small. Your deflection falls as 1 over the impact parameter. So first of all, look at these hard collisions. So here's the impact parameter. You square it to get a cross section. Multiply by the density, take the reciprocal, and you've got your mean free path. So a simple substitute, so pushing this into this gives you a mean free path. And then you can knock off one velocity to get the time. It's called the relaxation time. So this is what you end up with. The cube of the velocity and the density in the denominator, the square of the mass, and so on. Okay. But even at this stage, I'd like to point out that this is related to something we've talked about, which is the phase-space density. Because the inverse of the phase-space density. Because this is the density in real space, and they are dividing by the cube of the spread in velocity. So it's actually in the regions of high phase-space density that these collisional effects become important. Okay. So that's one thing to keep in mind. But there's also a nice way of writing this, which brings out this 1 over n that I told you about. You put in a simple estimate for the random velocities in the system, the relative velocities with which stars encounter each other, which is just the total mass and size. Right? This comes from the virial theorem, balance of. And then you have this dynamic, and this is a time. It's nice to look at something which is dimensionless. So you divide this time by the time it takes to start across the system, which is just R over V. So if you just plug these two into this, you get this ratio of hard collisions to dynamical time. And that simply turns out to be N. So if you like, everything else disappears. So the earlier remark that we are now looking at the discreteness of the system is now quantified to some extent. You're really saying that you have this cluster of stars, it has a dynamical time, so the time it takes a star to go across, and then you wait n dynamical times, the effects of these two body collisions come into the picture. Now, actually, this is an underestimate. What happens with Coulomb forces is that if you increase the impact parameter, the deflection becomes small, as 1 over b. And it's really the square of the deflection because it's a random walk. So it's 1 over b squared. But the cross section goes over b squared. So every logarithmic interval of impact parameter contributes equally. And there's a lot of intervals between the closest approach of two stars and the size of the system. And so there's this Coulomb logarithm, which is typically 20 or 40 or something like that. So actually, the picture of stars scattering is a little different from molecules scattering in a gas, which are all hard collisions. In the case of stars, it's a large number of small angle scatterings, which is closer to the Brownian motion of particles in a fluid, heavy particles in a fluid. Okay, so this is just to tell you that there are systems where the processes I'm talking about are important, even with n equals 10 raised to 6, which may surprise you a little bit. One is, of course, there are also some 4 pi's and so on which got left out. So it's n divided by some 20. And then there's the log n, which also helps. It also helps that the dynamical time in the globular cluster is pretty short. So at the end of the day, in a Hubble time, you can have tens or hundreds of tens or hundreds of relaxation times. And this is not an accident. I think we went back and said that if you had an isotropic velocity distribution, you would have a spherical system. Now, in the collisionless systems that we were talking about, if they had enough conservation laws, there was no reason to assume an isotropic velocity distribution. But in the globular clusters, these two bodies scattering will isotropize the velocity distribution, which is probably why they're globular. Now, this one doesn't look globular, and there are two reasons. One is that some kind of scale factor in the translation of the original picture onto this. The second is omega sen actually happens to be one of the most elliptical of the globular clusters, for reasons which are not fully understood. Perhaps it's a recent merger of two globular clusters, something like that. Okay? But believe me, this is globular, might be globular. And the fundamental reason is that this is a collisional system, velocities are isotropized, and so on. At least in the inner parts. Okay? But there's more to collisional systems than this. Now in laboratory systems, laboratory gases, you know, collisions just take you peacefully to a nice equilibrium state where concentrations are uniform, densities are uniform. But this works the other way. Now we, right at the beginning, I had this example of a system with an exponential in the energy as a distribution function. And that gave rise to the so-called isothermal sphere, right? Which was the solution of del squared phi is e raised to minus phi. So that's just reminding you of what we had there. So you'd say, well, here's a nice model for a globular cluster. Now, a couple of things. If you, this actually has infinite mass because the density falls as 1 over r squared. But of course, real globular clusters are finite. The other thing is if you really have a Maxwellian distribution of velocities, and some of them are going to be above the escape velocity, they're going to get out. And this was already known in the 30s. But this evaporation has an interesting consequence. It removes energy from the globular cluster. But this the energy becomes more negative. It's already a bound system. It becomes more negative. So the potential energy becomes more negative, but the kinetic energy actually increases. So I mean, this is sort of, you must have heard this remark that gravitating systems have negative specific heat. I mean, to the extent that one can make any sense of it, this is what it means. You extract energy from it, and if they still continue to obey the virial theorem, then what is interesting is that the phase space density increases in this part. Now, that doesn't violate entropy because, of course, these escaping stars carry away a huge amount of entropy. They have a huge amount of space to explore. So your relaxation time gets shorter and shorter. So which actually means that in these globular clusters, they are heading for a disaster of some kind. Right? The stars evaporate, the central part shrinks, so the real space density increases, the velocity dispersion also increases, but the net result is that the phase space density increases, and so on and so forth. Okay. So you actually, the other interesting thing which happens is that heavier stars sink to the center of the globular cluster. Actually that has, I mean, just to make a strange connection between being an observatory and basic theory, the first serious pulsar survey in our observatory was targeted at the globular cluster, right at the center, because neutron stars are heavy, and if they're in binary system, they're even heavier, and they sort of sink to the bottom. And they were lucky, they found one. But as often happened, they found a very interesting one, a very eccentric one. And as often happened in astronomy, it's taken them a long time to find the next one. Anyway, so all these non-equilibrium phenomena appear spontaneously. You get gradients in the squared velocity, you get gradients in the masses. And well, one more interesting thing is if you go back to Landau-Lifshitz, they do one thing which not many statistical mechanics people do. They set up a Gibbs distribution for a system with net angular momentum. So this is a Lagrange multiplier for the angular momentum. You have a e raised to minus beta e, and you have a e raised to minus some vector dot the angular momentum. And that vector turns out to be an angular velocity. Okay? If you do it right. So the angular velocity is sort of supposed to be constant in a system, which is very reasonable. It's rigid rotation. Because you know if there was any differential rotation, then some viscous process would sort of damp it up. But again, these systems go the wrong way. And even if there was rotation to start with, the angular momentum gets concentrated toward the outer parts of the system. In fact, again, the kind of very academic way of constructing this is to say the following. Suppose you ask me to construct a globular cluster model with a fixed angular momentum. The way I do it is I ignore the angular momentum constraint and construct it with the maximum entropy and zero angular momentum, and I put all the angular momentum in one star orbiting. So far away that it hardly contributes to anything. Okay. So gravitating systems sort of, they violate our usual intuition about thermodynamics. And actually, it goes deeper. So this is my last picture, but this is interesting. I mean, it's known to people in the trade, but it's still interesting. Now, clearly, you would not want to stick minus 1 over. So now let's really think of the n-bodies. They have a potential minus 1 over R12, right? You would not want to stick that into a canonical distribution because you would have e raised to plus 1 over R12, which is very pathological. Okay? On the other hand, you might say, well, maybe I can go microcanonicals. So let me restrict the total energy. Turns out even that does not work. And a little bit of power computation shows that you, suppose you take a pair of stars and you say, I want them to have a binding energy EB. And then you sort of count the phase volume below that, below EB, more tightly bound than EB. A little simple power computation tells you that it goes as EB to be power of minus 3/2. And the minus 3/2 comes from two things, a plus 3/2 from the momentum. And since the distance between the stars are the order 1 over E, so you're E to the minus 3 and E to the plus 3/2. So that's how you get this. So the density of states for a binary, so to speak, is E to the minus 5/2, right? Because you integrate this, you get this. I mean, this is the cumulative and this is the differential. So now take N plus 2 particles, okay? And for two of them, let's put them into a tight configuration with a binding energy EB. So that has a tail going to negative energies of E to the minus 5/2. Now the remaining ones, let's just stick in a free particle density of states, which is E raised to thrice N plus 1 by 2 minus 1. I think I have explained this. One, there are N plus 2 particles. Two of them we have been put in a binary, but the center of mass of the binary can still move around like a free particle. So that's why I have put in N plus 1 free particle. So you just convolve these and you will see it diverges even for N equal to 1. So even with three bodies in a box, you construct a constant energy surface, as the Satmik books tell you to do, and you end up with something infinite. And actually, there was a nice piece of insight by someone who's not as well known as Leonard Bell or Fermi. This is Douglas Hagee of Edinburgh. That this actually corresponds to something physical happening in global clusters. So you actually have a tight binary. So it's got a large orbital velocity. And then you throw in a test star. So that's like a rapidly rotating fan and some bouncing a ball off it, and it just comes off at a higher velocity. And then, of course, it gets more tightly bound. And the whole process repeats. So more and more stars now are in the regime where they're going to gain energy from it. And so the fact that we do see all these binaries, binary pulsars, and so on in the global cluster has something to do with this. It also means that there's a significant energy source in the middle of the globular cluster. So, you know, it acts as a heat source for the rest of the globular cluster. So actually, what started out as a simple n-body problem, you know, with given total energy and so on, turns out to be a very interesting time-dependent problem. Okay. So let me stop here. This is just a kind of crash course in galactic dynamics, touching on different things, some of which you may encounter in your pursuit of very fundamental issues in cosmology and so on. And some of which is just interesting physics anyway. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Chaitram. So, any questions? So, let me start with one. Can you tell us a little bit about this magnetic fluid?
Okay, I can tell you that. There is a theorem, again. I mean, much of this is just things I've collected from the literature. So if you look at Parker's book, he would like to construct magneto-hydrostatic equilibrium. So you have magnetic field and you have fluids on it, right? And I think under some conditions, you have situations where the magnetic field lines act as a shock for the pressure. So the pressure is constant along the magnetic field lines. So now magnetic field lines are a bit like particle trajectories. They can either lie on surfaces, or they can fill a volume, right? So it turns out that if, in order to get sensible equilibrium solutions, you really want pressure gradients, right, in real space. So the magnetic field lines are forced to lie on magnetic surfaces, which a priori is not obvious. If you just take a magnetic field line, it could fill a three-dimensional volume. But if you want an equilibrium configuration, they actually lie on surfaces. So in some sense, they become integral. So I think this is a theorem due to Parker, and some of his students elaborated the theorem and so on. So that's the closest parallel I can think
but
of.
But that is spherical, is that what you're saying?
No. It can be. Okay. One is not assuming any geometric symmetry. You know?
Okay.
So, but what one is saying is that the magnetic field lines in equilibrium configurations should lie on magnetic surfaces, which is not so.
So they're dynamically driven towards the surface.
Pardon?
They're dynamically driven towards the surface.
Yes, they're dynamically driven. And I'm sort of saying, I guess people have said similar things, that the galaxy system is dynamically driven towards a potential where the particle trajectories do not go all over the place, but are restricted to, you know, three action variables.
Do you have any insight for why that should happen?
Well, not beyond what I told you, that if you take a nine model of violet relaxation, that you mix an angle, then your distribution function becomes a function of action variables. And of course, if you don't have action variables, then I can't find equilibrium configuration. So I presume the system just keeps evolving to the fine scale.
It finds action
variables.
Right.
So it's exactly what you said. It's a kind of selection. And I find that purely as a piece of physics very interesting, that you know, magnetic fields select configurations of magnetic surfaces, and particle orbits in galaxies select configurations with. Yeah, you know, if it's just energy, the particle will move in five phase dimensions, but in the integrable systems, it moves in three. So the reduction from five to three is a selection. Anyway, that's my one sort of take on this whole thing. Okay, you want something really wild? You can ask, why did the Kerr black hole select additional constants of motion? But this is why.
Right? Why?
It's right. It's axis symmetric, so
yeah.
Certainly, no harm in it's conserving energy and the z component of angular momentum, but it also has this Kerr's constant. I'm sure there's no connection, but that one system, which again is more symmetric or more integrable than it should be.
So I'm a complete novice in most of this, but one thing I've been wondering for years, how confident are we that general acoustic effects will not be significant in this galactic dynamics?
Actually, it turns out that much of the formalism goes to Edison phase space in general relativity. And you might modify the way you go back from the potential to the. In fact, there's no longer one potential. Right? You have a whole metric, and there's no longer one density. You have all the stresses. But I think there's actually a pretty reasonable general relativistic formulation of stellar dynamics, which structurally would not be very different from this. Okay, there would be issues like gauge choice. So
yeah, but could general acoustic effects be responsible for the results you're looking at here, which you can't find directly from Newtonian? Because your potentials, as you say, they're not multiple potentials. It's a more complex nonlinear problem.
Okay. I haven't thought of that. I just meant to say that a lot of things, like the phase-based constraint and so on, would actually go through instruments. Plus, if you do general relativistic collisional dynamics, of course, that was explored a lot in the context of the formation of black holes.
Yes.
In fact, I had this strange experience once sitting in Santa Barbara, like in the lunch break in a conference. They put up a movie, so I watched the movie, and it was a beautiful movie made by the Cornell group of a relativistic star cluster. And then they had these wavefronts coming out from the center, and then as it formed the black hole, they sort of froze. And the thing that removed the thing, the movie stopped, and they said, okay, now we will show you the same movie in a different gauge. but that's actually a very good piece of work by Shapiro.
I would have guessed that since the velocities of nanorelativistic are small in compared to speed of light, then you would guess that the relativistic corrections are small.
I'm sure he had that in mind. But there are cases in physics where a small correction makes something possible, which was not possible before. But at least it would not violate the general notions of packing things in phase space and so on. That would survive here.
So if we don't have any other questions, then I just wanted to say, so we're going to take a general beginner probably around 6 special today.
Mm-hmm.
Around 6 in the lobby.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's thank Rajaram again.
You must be wondering how I survive an observation.